Our last case for our oral calendar for today is case number A18-2029, Igbagnugo versus Jennings. Are both counsel present for?
Are present.
Okay. And both counsel will have 15 minutes for your arguments, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. Please be feel free to lower and raise the podium as you need it. Make sure you watch the clock to stay within time. You'll see the light, and it'll indicate how much time you have left. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you. Please, the court. Frankly, I'm embarrassed to be here today because this isn't something I should have wasted my time or energy on. I hired this nice fellow, Mr. Do repair work in my house. I woke up and there was leaking in the ceiling, so I called SurfPro because I see their ad all the time on CNN, which I watch regularly. And he came in and looked at it, gave me an estimate, two estimates. One for something called a popcorn ceiling and one for flat ceiling. I had popcorn. Most houses built in the 70s or 80s have popcorn ceiling. The new modern thing now is a flat ceiling or what have you. Mine was all popcorn. So, and he gave two estimates. One was popcorn and one was flat ceiling. And the flat ceiling turned out to be cheaper. So I said, okay, I'll do the flat ceiling cheaper. I was under the impression that this was a flat fee agreement. How much to fix my work, you tell me, then I choose. He gave me a figure for the flat fee, I chose the cheaper one. So he starts work, I give him half the payment. So as they were coming close to finishing and they started doing the flat thing, my wife came in one day and liked it. I said, hey, why don't you give me an estimate of how it costs to do this for the whole house. I kind of looked at her and rolled my eyes because I wasn't going to do it anyway. So she said, give me an estimate. And then we got an estimate that said it was going to be $10,000. So I said, that's a non-starter. We're not going to do that. So at the end of the construction, he gives me a bill that's $2,000 more. So I said, why? He said, well, it's within the scope of work. He tells me all these things I don't understand. I said, we had a flat fee. He said, no. It wasn't a flat fee within the scope of work. We could do this and do that. I said, but I read your contract. It says that for there to be a change, there has to be a writing signed by me. He says, yeah, but it also says that I just have to give you notice in writing. And I said, okay, you didn't even give me that notice. He says, yeah, I did. I said, when? He says, I sent you a revised estimate. I said, when? He said, the one I sent you, said he identified the estimate. I said, oh, the pop counseling, the estimate for the flat fee ceiling that my wife requested for the whole house, that's what you're calling your notice? He said, yeah,
that's the notice. But that notice also did reference the bathtub change, which was kind of the most significant change, wasn't it? The fact that you put a new tub in and then it required a plumber to come out and install a new tub as opposed to just doing work around it?
No, no.
No, that's
there was
not
a plumber required from the very first instance. And I'll tell you this. If you look at the exhibit, I point this out very clearly. The very first estimate, which is trial exhibit 2, line item 48, shows that plumbing services were required, PLM, plumber. There's a fee for that, $1,087. Page 6 of that, it has a line item for a plumber. Okay, and actually, I tried to explain this away because at some point, there was a question on direct examination of Mr. SurfPro. There was a direct examination where he said, no, plumbing wasn't contemplated. In fact, the plumber was brought in later. Then you look at exhibit number, trial exhibit 8, which is the plumbing bill. The plumbing bill was from the 12th, the day the project started, because the plumber came in and the regulations require that plumbers do certain things. If you're not a licensed plumber, there are certain things you can't do in a home, like cut off water and do this and that. It was required from the get-go. And I was there that morning. He came first in the morning, the plumber, and looked at the house and gave his estimate. He did some of the diagnosis. So why would he say, and testify in court under oath that a plumber was never contemplated while the plumber was there the first day and helped as part of the work. And it's right there in black and white. So, and the conciliation court in this case actually split the money in half from the disparity. And that would have been fine with me. I would have lived with that because I already gave up $500 that I used to buy the tub and the marbles and all that stuff. So that would have been fine with me. The thing is that he weaponized the mechanic's lien and afflicted my home with the mechanic's lien when he knew I was going through financing. And I warned him not to do it. I warned him not to do it on two occasions, in writing and when I ran into him at the Holiday gas station by my house. I said, hello. He said, hello, civilly. I said, hey, listen, I want this to be resolved amicably. Why don't I pay you what I owe you? The balance of $2,000 left. You pick an arbitrator of your own choice. Whatever that arbitrator rules, I'll pay it. Just don't put a lien on my home. He went like this, and I left. Then he puts a lien on my home and sues me in conciliation court. Now, I would have agreed with the conciliation court and paid that and walked away. But it took so long. The fact that he put a lien is what really upset me. Now, if you can do this to a lawyer, imagine what the general public, they don't stand a chance with them. And we get to trial. For everything that happened, the court rules there's no evidence in the record. While the court admitted everything, all the pleadings, everything was admitted at the end of trial. And even on cross-examination, I got him to admit 5 times that this was a repair and was not an improvement to property, which means the mechanic's lien is illegal, which means the attorney's fees based on that mechanic's lien is out the window and everything else. The trial court judge never ruled on it, never ruled on whether it was a repair or an improvement. And all the testimony I elicited on cross-examination are evidentiary in nature and has a lot of value. My wife testified, appellant, that, yeah, I came in the house, I asked for this estimate, and I outlined him in my briefs, all the testimony, just as it's easy for the court to look at. He says, no, I never thought it was going to be more money, and that Mr. Jennings never explained anything to us. If you're supposed to have something in writing, you have it in writing directly and say, this is the new estimate for this, this is the changes. But he buries it in some other estimate and charges double and then testifies untruthfully.
Well, to the extent that you're challenging the credibility of the witnesses, that's something we defer to the district court for. We generally don't review that on appeal.
Oh, it doesn't even matter because the black and white is there from what he did. I'm not challenging his credibility. The court ruled what it ruled. But if it's black and white right here, they never even disputed in their briefs. They have never addressed any of these concrete things that I put down regarding the plumbing and what date and whether it was not contemplated, regarding whether the plumbing work was part of the original agreement, regarding whether it was a repair or not. They never addressed it, so it's waived necessarily under Supreme Court precedent. They have not addressed the potent issues I alleged.
What issues are waived? This sounds like a new argument. Did you raise that issue in your briefing in terms of waiver of argument?
Yes, I did. I can cite to it directly on my briefing. In my reply brief on page 17.
That's in your reply brief, though.
Excuse me?
That's in your reply brief. You raised the issue of waiver.
Yeah, because in their own brief, they never responded to what I alleged in my brief. So in my opening brief, I said all these things. Said here, address this and this and that. They never addressed any of it, other than just tell a shitty story. They never said why was there a contract that was the amount of $6,700 on that first day that was sent to me mistakenly. I have it in the record. There's a contract that was $2,000 more. In fact, the exact amount that they charged me after the end, it was there. It was sent to me mistakenly, created the same day I signed the agreement. They never explained that. So And they didn't explain a few other things, like the line item that said, from the first line item that I cited, it's page 6 of the first contract, he says there's a line item for plumbing work, and he testifies baldly that there's no, that the plumber was never contemplated. But the regulations, the municipal rules, require that a plumber do certain things. So a plumber was contemplated.
But wasn't the argument that the scope of the work the plumber was called upon to do changed from the initial estimate because of the decision you made to put in a new bathtub that was larger and required different connections?
Yeah, first of all, on cross-examination, I asked him if he knew whether the size, what the size of the tub, whether it was wider. He says, I didn't think it was wider. Whether it was taller, I believe it was taller. Well, do you have anything in writing that says, I'm going to change this now because your bathtub is taller? No, the bathtub wasn't taller. That's my contention. But again, that's neither here nor there.
Mr. Court seems to have found otherwise.
Yes, based on the testimony of Mr. Jennings.
Right, but as Judge Reyes pointed out, we generally defer to those credibility determinations if there's evidence in the record to support them.
Okay, then tell me this. How is there a plumber on the first day at work with his invoice making part of the determination? So the district court decides to be blind to the truth. I can't do much about that, but I'm hoping that the Court of Appeals will open their eyes to the truth. This is the 12th, the day started. If he was never contemplated and was supposed to come in subsequently after the discovery of the tub that was delivered on the 15th, how is that invoiced by the plumber on the 12th? Somebody tell me that. It's right there in black and white. I think I'll reserve the rest of my time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I represent the respondent. My name is Kevin Laren. Your Honors, just to respond to a couple points that appellant has brought up on the bathtub issues and so on, and the plumber's date specifically. Whether that date is correct or not, I don't really know. But the point is, he didn't bring the plumber to trial to testify as to whether that date was accurate or not, possibly. So the point is, all the things appellants is bringing up, he never proved at trial. He never called, he never had himself testify on his own behalf as to what these things he's talking about, whether they were true or not. So he's kind of alleging a lot of things that are speculative at this point. The court did go over in great detail the estimates to figure out what was the issue with the tub and the licensed plumber. As my client stated in testimony, which the court agreed with, he did have to bring in a licensed plumber because the tub had changed in size and it had to be realigned properly with the drain. And that's why a licensed plumber was required at that point. Prior to that, it would have just been simply removing the existing tub and replacing it. So the original estimates...
Had it required a plumber?
Not that I know of. He said it didn't when he was testifying.
Okay, but on the April 12th estimate, there does seem to be some reference to plumber.
It could have been just the way it's worded on the estimate. I can't tell you for sure. It could have been a line item for reconnecting plumbing, possibly. Once again, I think Mr. Appellant here had the chance to cross-examine on those issues and didn't really make his point, if that was his point indeed. This case presents the all-too-common problem of parties who undertake a construction project and don't have clear controls over the extras as they come, as work progresses. At issue here is whether a contract signed by the parties was a fixed-fee contract, as appellant contends, or whether it was a contract subject to modification, as respondent contends and proved at trial. The trial court correctly found, based on the evidence presented at trial, that the parties intended the contract to be subject to modification. First, the trial court found that the contract did contain an ambiguity. What the court said was the contract didn't explicitly state whether it could be modified. So the court treated that as an ambiguity in the contract. Therefore, he looked to the intent of the parties to determine the contours of the contract. And the standard of proof for the trial court was preponderance of the evidence. So based on the evidence presented at trial, the trial court made numerous factual findings to support respondents' contention that the parties intended to have a contract that was subject to modification as work commenced. First, the two initial contract estimates emailed to appellants back in February were labeled as estimates explicitly on the cover email. There was also a further note by a respondent that until the tub was removed and damage could be assessed, that there were certain items that weren't even given costs yet simply because they don't know till they get in there and assess the damage. It's hidden until that point. Second, the contract did not contain any price limitations or restrictions for the various categories of work to be performed.
But it did suggest, I'm looking at paragraph 11 of the contract, authorization to perform services. I mean, that yes, it suggested modification is appropriate, but it's supposed to be signed by both parties. We don't have that here.
That's correct. Yes, Your Honor. And that's kind of the crux of this case. That's common in a lot of construction contracts. New Ulm talks about that. Other cases talk about that, where there's a contract that requires a writing. Whether it has to be signed or not, maybe another matter, but it requires a writing for any modifications to be made. What happens in practice is, and what the court recognized, is that parties will deal with things many times orally, for instance, and not even do the writing. And the courts have found that the owners of the property will remain liable for instance, oral agreements that were not put in writing as a contract explicitly required. So that's well-settled law in Minnesota. It's been done many times. And the court, in fact, found in this case that because appellants directed many of the changes, were involved in the changes, that they essentially waived Clause 11 of the contract so that it no longer applied to this case. And that's true in New Ulm and other cases. Same concept.
I have a question. It seems from appellant's argument and from the brief that the use of the mechanics lien was a particular item of damage that the appellants alleged in this case. And the district court concludes that it's a moot issue. I'm not sure mootness is the first thing that comes to my mind. Could there still not be damage flowing from that, especially all the time and energy the appellant had to expend in trying to get it released and having to deposit money into the court for something that should never have been levied on the property in the first place?
Sure, the court recognized that his claim regarding the attorney's lien, damages, injunction, whatever, was still viable. Putting money deposit on the court simply released the lien from his property so that he could continue to refinance his property, which was happening at that particular time. In the summary judgment hearing, appellants even said when it was brought up that I am able to obtain refinancing based on some other workout he had with this refinancing company. So the lien wasn't an issue at that point. So what the court said was, at this point, it's basically not of the essence. Let's produce more evidence, more discovery on this issue down the line. So what he did was he allowed appellants to conduct discovery, make requests, do depositions, whatever it might take to further prove their case as far as damages as to the mechanics lien. And appellant just failed to do so at any point after that. Never any new motions.
Does that render an issue moot or simply not proven? That's my question. I don't understand how it becomes moot.
Well, I agree. The term moot is used loosely. I believe the more proper term is he never proved it when he had the chance at trial in particular. He never brought it up at trial. He never confronted my client about the mechanics lien. He never provided any testimony about the mechanics lien. He never offered any evidence as to damages of the mechanics lien. He never testified himself regarding the mechanics lien. So he had plenty of opportunities to prove this, whether by motions prior to trial or at trial itself. He just failed to do so. So yes, in that case, he just failed to prove his case, period. And I would consider that now waived. Moot may be a term not properly used, but I think it has the same effect.
I have a question regarding the original agreement. One of the allegations in appellant's brief is that it's basically an adhesion contract. And my question to you is, and this might be outside the record, but is that contract one that's ever been modified at all? Is that one that could a party modify it at all?
That's a good question, and it never came up in any of the proceedings whether the contract itself could be modified. I mean, the bottom line is it was modified. It certainly wasn't a contract of adhesion. I don't think the court found any evidence of that. There was no evidence presented that it was a contract of adhesion. He certainly had the opportunity to decline these contracts. A contract of adhesion is essentially you have no choice but to accept it. That was not the case here. He took like 45 days to accept one of the estimates. So,
well, that's a different issue as to whether or not you accept the contract from whether or not you can modify any of the terms, including, for example, let's say attorney fees or anything along those lines, or the ability to put on a mechanics lien on someone or the property.
You know, I suppose that's always a possibility, but the contract, it's a corporate contract. I mean, that's what they use in their standard business practice. It was never challenged by appellant. He didn't say, I want to rewrite the terms of this contract. So he presumably had the opportunity to read it, to understand it. He is a lawyer. He's been a lawyer for 20-some years. So it's not like he's a novice at reading contracts and understanding them. So had he wanted to bargain, he certainly could have. And either side could have walked away if that was the case. Like, no, we can't accept that. But that didn't happen. So, as I was stating previously, the court found that based on the evidence of the parties presented at trial, that the court was subject to modification. The only evidence presented at trial, or only credible evidence the court found, was by Respondent Jennings. He did the majority of the testimony about everything that happened. Appellant's wife did testify a little bit, but the court found her not to be credible. Mr. Igbenugo did not testify on his own behalf at all. So essentially, appellants didn't provide any evidence to the contrary of what Mr. Jennings testified to. And the courts then also found that changes were made and directed by appellant while the project progressed, which once again goes to the issue of waiving Clause 11 of that contract, that you can waive that writing if you agree and direct the changes while the contract is being performed. That brought up my next argument, was simply that the court had to then look to whether appellants waived Clause 11 of the contract, and the court found that, in fact, he did, because just like in New Ulm and the other cases, he directed changes and agreed to them as things moved on. For instance, the crown molding broke when they tried to take it down. He was told it has to be replaced. New crown molding has to be purchased and stained, and then, of course, cut and rehung. The ceiling needed a new skim coat. The texture wasn't coming off properly. Things that happen in construction contracts. And then the tub issue, because it was just a larger tub, required more work required by a plumber to make it all fit. Another piece of evidence that was important was the plumber. Appellant was with the plumber the day he was there. He could have testified on his own behalf what date that was. He never did. So there's nothing in the record to suggest what date the plumber was actually there. But the point is, he was with the plumber. The plumber made recommendations, and appellant declined some of those recommendations, which supports the theory that he thought it would cost more if he accepted those recommendations. If it was flat fee, no increased price, you'd have him do everything. Why wouldn't you? It would just make sense. He said some of the effect of he could fix whatever the plumber was recommending with Flex Seal. So as far as the written amendment to the contract, to the initial contract, that was actually provided by my client. The important thing to note there is that the contract included the new work already agreed to, the new crown molding, the new skim coat on the ceiling, and then it also included doing the entire main level ceiling, which appellants rejected that part of it. They did not reject the new changes that already had to be made. So that was all included in that third written amendment that was given to him. As far as appellant's contention that the court never ruled on improvements versus repair, things like that, again, that would have come up at trial, and he didn't provide any evidence whatsoever whether it was an improvement, a repair. You know, at trial, the terms are used loosely. I mean, it's not a legal term we're using. It's just how people talk. We repaired this, we fixed that, we replaced this. So there is no legal determination of improvement versus repair. So as far as the issue of the mechanics lien, there again, he failed to prove that the mechanics lien was void, illegal, that he is entitled to damages.
Did the district court ever declare a mechanics lien?
I'm sorry, what was
that? Did the district court ever declare a mechanics lien? You just had a mechanics lien statement filed, then there was a payment into court, and then there's a judgment. Was there ever a lien declared on the property?
Yes, there was a lien filed, yes.
The lien statement was filed.
I just remember statement of a mechanics lien, yes.
Right. But that's a claim of a mechanics lien, and then the existence of the lien under 514, I can't remember the name of the chapter, but has to be declared by the district court.
Sure.
Was that ever declared?
No, it was not. No, the mechanics lien issue was simply dropped after the initial summary judgment hearing, period.
Because of the deposit, because of what the parties did to...
So, appellant still had the right to prove damages, he just didn't do it. That's the point. And, Your Honor, my time is just about up, so I will stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Bynco?
Thank you. All counsel has done again is try to bamboozle the court with generalities, specific things. He says we didn't prove that it was a repair mechanics lien, and his client was so credible at trial, he admitted five times that it was a repair work, his own testimony. Two, I had affidavits, four or five affidavits on file. The court admitted all of this evidence. So is it meaningless that the court admitted my affidavits and everything else that goes to prove the case? He admitted this, it was offered by him at trial. The court admitted this is evidence. Testimonial evidence by affidavit and by documents. So to say that there's no evidence in the record is simply fiction. The evidence was there. The crown molding, I did argue, what happened with the crown molding? They broke it, taking it down. They've been there for years. They broke it. And I came in the house, they showed me it was broken. I said, fine, I'll pay for it, no big deal. That's what I said with the crown molding. I knew the guy did it wrong. He said he was sorry. I said, fine, I'll pay for the crown molding. I didn't know they were gonna charge me $1,400 for a piece of wood going around the living room that's one third of this space, okay? Intent of the parties, the district court found that we intended to, we had a meeting of the minds. Now, if you see the flurry of emails that went between 5/11/16 and 5/19/16, exhibit 10, as soon as he sent me that bill that had 2,000 more, it was fireworks, emails. And what's better to show intent of the parties than that email flurry where I challenged my, I said, this is not what we discussed, this and this and that. And then the court saw that and still said there was a meeting of the minds. Now, I suppose if there weren't mistakes by district courts, there wouldn't be a court of appeals. And if there were mistakes with the court of appeals, there wouldn't be the Supreme Court. Nobody's perfect. The court chose to see the way he did with regardless of any evidence I presented. I don't know why. Maybe I looked like a bully and I was the lawyer. But I was the one that was oppressed by my client. I begged him to resolve this amicably because I didn't want to be here. I knew what it would take to be here. It's wasted a lot of my time, probably $30,000 in time. I don't want to be here. Now, he also, being so credible, admitted that he understood, that I understood it to be a flat fee. If you want me to show you where he said that, I'll show you. He understood it, that I understood it to be a flat fee. He said it himself. And he's very credible. Okay? So how can he now claim that he didn't understand that?
Well, but that's an issue of what he thought you believed it to be. That's my understanding in terms of how you argued it in your brief.
Then there was no meeting of the minds. If you understood that I understood that, then he should have known that I expected the flat fee and not for him to increase anything without asking me to sign it or without giving me proper notice. If he really wanted to give me proper notice about the increase, he should have sent it to me, not buried it somewhere else. He's sneaky. He was sneaky about it, pure and simple. The discourse chose not to believe it, but I know it's true. He knows it's true. That's all I know. He knows it's true. When you meet somebody early morning with a cup of coffee and say, hey, let's resolve this. Let me give you your money. Pick somebody, I'll go with it. That's good faith. I was never trying to bully him, and he knew what I had to go through. I had to put in escrow $9,000, very stressed out about this running up and down, simply because he decided to violate his own contracts. He testified that there was no writing anywhere that said, where he said specifically to me and explained it to me, that there was going to be more. I take care of a lot of people in Africa. I'm not just here by myself. 100 people depend on me. I can't spend money like that. That's why, in fact, my wife testified if we had known it was going to be $100 more, we wouldn't have done it. And that's why I chose the cheaper estimate, okay? And he admitted in testimony also that he has problems with a lot of his clients because he does that. He has an open-ended contract. So a client will never get the benefit of the bargain. And the public has complained about him a lot. I provided evidence of someone that as soon as he saw the extent of the insurance, he raised his fee. And that client reported him to the Better Business Bureau. So no matter what it is, I believe I've met the evidentiary burden. His own admissions alone is enough to find against him. And the district court did what it did. I don't know why. I can't explain it.
Thank you both, counsel. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. That is our last case for our oral calendar, and the court is now in recess. Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you.